When is a child's kiss an innocent show of affection, and when could it be sexual harassment? Some public school officials are having a hard time telling the difference. One recent incident involved a 6-year-old, another a 7-year-old. Both were disciplined for kissing a classmate. Neither turned out to be a case of sexual harassment, yet both are reminders that sexual harassment policy in schools is difficult to interpret. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Dr. Nan Stein, one of the nation's leading authorities on the issue of sexual harassment in schools, says there are two reasons why teachers and principals often overreact, even to the slightest hint of sexual harassment.
They're afraid of lawsuits, of sexual harassment lawsuits, of which there are many around the country. And the second thing is that they've been without really firm guidance.
And it's not for lack of guidelines either, says Stein, a professor at Wellesley College, where she heads the Center for Research on Women. Stein says teachers' unions, education associations, principals, and school boards all seem to have their own set of guidelines, each with their own interests and members in mind.
So we have a lot of explanations out there. We have court cases that vary sometime from one region of the country to another, even when the same set of facts are more or less, you know, applicable. So we have a wide variation about how people, you know, enforce federal civil rights law.
The nation's civil rights laws consider sexual harassment a form of sexual discrimination. And since 1972, the federal government has had the authority to investigate and punish sexual harassment on college campuses and schools that receive federal funding. The U.S. Education Department's Office of Civil Rights, says Assistant Secretary Norma Cantu, is there to say what sexual harassment is and what it's not.
What sexual harassment is a situation where there's an unwanted sexual advance or a request for sexual favor. And it's so severe and so persistent and so pervasive that it prevents students from learning, or it creates an abusive learning environment. That's plain English. That's common to understand.
This is applicable to the whole country, says Cantu, and it's the closest thing to a single standard with which to measure abuse. The rest has to be common sense. Take age, for example.
What our regulation anticipates is that sexual harassment could occur at any age. What teachers are dealing with is the insistence by parents and by the federal laws that the classrooms be free of gender discrimination that affect even very young children.
Including 6- and 7-year-olds, says Cantu. Most federal and state guidelines, of course, were written with older kids and adults in mind. Whether it's the classroom teacher who makes a pass at students or becomes romantically involved with a student, or the more common humiliation that kids put other kids through every day, the lewd and obscene language on bathroom walls, the sexual teasing, taunting, and touching on the school bus or in the hallways. But even in these settings, schools are overreacting, says Dr. Stein.
There are schools right now trying to ban hand-holding, you know, among kids, let alone, and that's a high school.
Sometimes it doesn't even matter what school officials do. Take the sexual harassment case decided this week in favor of a 14-year-old girl in Antioch, California, just north of San Francisco. A jury there awarded her $500,000 in damages after it concluded that school officials had ignored the girl's complaints about a boy in her class who daily would subject her to threats, obscenities, and vulgar insults. Antioch School Superintendent Alan J. Newell says the guidelines he needed were in place. There were at least 3 investigations, all inconclusive because it came down to one student's word against the word of another. Yet the girl's parents wanted the boy expelled.
And actually that was reviewed with his parents as well. And their attitude was he hadn't done anything. So, in other words, we felt like we were sort of in the middle of something that we couldn't clearly substantiate either way, and that we had at least the potential for legal action regardless of which way we decided.
What has astonished experts about the Antioch case is, first, the amount of money a jury was willing to award, and second, the fact that there was so little attention paid to the more profound issue of sexual harassment in a school setting. Children and teenagers are not being counseled about what constitutes sexual harassment. And in that respect, says Stein, schools are no different than what's happened on college campuses and on the job.
Kids aren't any different from adults in the sense that when this topic is discussed in the national media, just like Tail Hook and Packwood and Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, more grown-ups file complaints at that point. And so it's the same thing with schools, that when schools say, we have a sexual harassment policy, and here's the plan, and we're also going to have, you know, classes and, you know, embed this into the curriculum, what happens is more kids start coming forward.
The approach in schools, though, has usually been punitive, says Stein, because it costs too much money to try and prevent sexual harassment through education.
And I've actually spent a lot of my time designing classroom lessons and discussions because I feel like that's the best approach, rather than read kids the riot act in a school assembly or, you know, being lectured in the principal office. I mean, those are the kind of, you know, sweeping one-shot deals and, you know, notions that enlightenment is going to follow.
If school officials want better guidelines, experts say they don't exist. If they hope for fewer lawsuits, that's not likely to happen either. What educators, parents, and policymakers seem to be overlooking is the obvious, that it is possible to teach even the youngest kids, both at home and in the classroom, what kind of behavior is appropriate behavior. I'm Claudia Sanchez reporting.